The cast of the hit CBS series, The Big Bang Theory, which is, in case you didn't know, about nerdy scientists trying to negotiate life, features a bunch of actors who play scientists, except for Mayim Bialik, who actually is a scientist. She has a PhD in neuroscience. She stars as Amy Farrah Fowler, who was until recently Sheldon Cooper's quote-unquote friend that's a girl but not a girlfriend. And you may recognize her name from Blossom, another much-beloved series from the 90s. Now she has something else to her credit, a book from Simon & Schuster about parenting called Beyond the Sling, and I'm very happy that the multi-talented Mayim Bialik has come to our studios today. Hello.
Thank you.
I see you have two boys, Miles and Frederick, who are on the cover of the book. I wonder how many books you read before and after they were born about how to raise them.
Probably close to a dozen. It was part of the impetus for my anxiety as a parent, I feel like, was because of all the books I was reading that were telling me what I should do, what I shouldn't do, how I'm going to spoil my kid if I hold them too much, and all that kind of stuff. So part of my interest in just trying to learn to be a parent was to find what worked for us.
Do you know when people started reading books? Americans, I guess, started with Dr. Spock, but maybe there were earlier books?
Yeah, I actually, I don't know. I mean, Dr. Spock, you know, I was born in 1975, so I was part of that generation, as it were. But my parents were born during World War II. Three of my four grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe, so parenting was very different. And, you know, I was raised in a fairly typical, you know, I call it like a pleasant dictatorship kind of household. They told me when I was happy, when I was sad, when I was hungry, when I was cold, you know.
You say your mother and your mother-in-law spent their first few years as parents, quote, being utterly confused, frustrated, and overwhelmed with feelings of inadequacy.
Yeah, I think a lot of the parenting style that they were told to have didn't sit right with a lot of women. You know, my mother-in-law says she was literally sent home from the hospital and told, you know, don't feed him unless it's 4 hours, you know, watch your clock. And she said she put him down and he was hungry every two. And she was really utterly baffled because the establishment was telling her he shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are all these different approaches. We just recently spoke to someone who's written a book about the way the French bring up their mm-hmm. kids. And I think they're on the leave them crying for a while, at least 4 hours.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, I've read some of what you're talking about. You know, to me, there's a strong emphasis in every culture, you know, for particularities about children. And children being seen and not heard is valued in certain cultures. And being able to go to fancy, expensive restaurants is valued for a lot of families. But I guess the style of parenting that sits well with me is not necessarily prioritizing obedience and, quote, goodness, but rather building a relationship in a family that's healthy for all.
Well, how did you figure out your own way? What you call attachment parenting. Did your training as a neuroscientist play a role in this? Or, or did your experience in sitcoms?
No. That doesn't prepare you for a lot. No, two things happened simultaneously. One, I was working on a PhD in neuroscience, in which we're trained in embryology, and my thesis was on the hormones of attachment, oxytocin and vasopressin. And so I did a lot of study about that. But while that was going on, friends of ours started having kids, and in particular two families from Northern California, where ideas flow freely, were parenting this way. And honestly, I thought it was crazy. I thought they had no life. It looked ridiculous. This whole, like, elimination communication. Can't you just put your kid in a diaper? You know, I mean, that was really what I thought. But as I continued in my studies and also watched these families grow, what I saw was that these were people who didn't parent by fear. And they didn't parent with judgment, and they weren't hitting their kids, they weren't speaking harshly, and the children were not perfect, but it was working.
Well, how did they come to that? Because in my experience, when my parents had four kids, they figured it out as they went along. Unfortunately, I was the first, and they hadn't yet figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
By the fourth, they had a pretty good idea of what to do.
Right, but I think, again, you know, every family decides what works for them. And for some families, you know, conditioning a newborn to be sleep independent is very important. And sometimes it's important for all four of your kids. But I think this notion of a child-centered psychological philosophy is new-ish to our culture. We mainly resonate in what we call parent-centered psychology kind of circles.
So you deviate from the conventional wisdom these days in terms of sleeping, breastfeeding, carrying the baby, mm-hmm. discipline, Can you talk about how you do disagree and how, I mean, it's totally different from Pamela Druckerman's
Bring
a Bebe, the French approach.
Sure. I mean, I guess the notion, both as a neuroscientist and, as someone who, as I said, was told a lot of shoulds, the human body is made to give birth, and the World Health Organization...
Well, yours is, not mine.
I'm sorry. Yes. The female human body is made to give birth. The World Health Organization, many legitimate medical academic authorities are now saying breastfeeding is the optimal way to feed a mammal, which, you know, again, is no surprise to those of us who are biologically inclined. Sleeping next to babies, sleeping near babies, holding your baby, allowing those hormones to be stimulated every 2 hours, which is when breastfeeding usually wants to occur in the early weeks. Those are things that mammals do, and we do them for a reason.
Well, I've heard objections to all of those things. For example, sleeping with your baby, you might roll over, especially when the baby is really small.
Yeah, that's actually not.
Doesn't happen?
So the issue with safe co-sleeping and the need for a recommendation to not sleep with newborns is because there hasn't been a lot of wide-scale education about the ways to guarantee safe co-sleeping. And, you know, for a lot of people, it sounds very commonsensical. Don't sleep with a ton of blankets. You know, don't sleep with your baby if you take drugs that make you unable to be roused. You know, things like that. But there is nothing... There is nothing wrong, weird, or dangerous about safely sleeping with a newborn.
What about breastfeeding? Is it is breastfeeding for a long time unrealistic for most working mothers?
In theory, I mean, I pumped till my son was three. I went back to work when he was 1.5, and I did pump until he was three. It may not work for everyone, and I think that's sort of an overarching concept. I'm not a pediatrician. I didn't write a book about how you should parent. Breastfeeding for 6 months is recommended with no supplements, nothing else.
Although not all women produce the right kind of milk.
So that's
feel guilty.
So that's actually not true. So with the proper resources, education, and support, every woman should be able to breastfeed. Women are told a lot, you don't have enough milk, you're not making enough, the baby's hungry. Those are things that we're not told by people who actually know about breastfeeding. And beyond that, as much as it's mutually desired, it is okay to breastfeed a child beyond 6 months, to wait a year to give solids as we did. It's okay. And also, I get to do what works for us, and you get to do what works for you.
My guest is Mayim Bialik, who has written a book called Beyond the Sling, with an introduction by Dr. Jay Gordon. But next to your name is a PhD. Is that there inform some people who might assume that this is a fun book because of your
partly,
comedic
yes.
background?
I'm not really a fun person. That's just the God's honest truth.
You just play one on television?
I just play one on television. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of celebrity parenting books. That's true. But I guess what Simon & Schuster, you know, hopes to set me aside as, and sort of the voice that I made for myself on Kveller.com, which is the parenting site that I really began writing for and where I found my voice, the notion is, I am a mom, I happen to be a public person, but my background is also informing what intuitively made sense to me.
Now, how far does this extend? For example, you began acting fairly young. Some kids begin even earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Would you allow your kids to start acting before they reach puberty?
It's not something that I think my husband and I want to partake in. No, we don't want to be taking our kids to auditions. I started acting at 11, and I was active in school plays and really enjoyed it. But it's not. I did okay, but it's not a world that I would encourage for small people.
Well, you did two television pilots the same year, 1990, Malloy and Blossom.
Right, Malloy was with Jennifer Aniston,
and you
actually.
Were what, 15 years old?
No, I was in Beaches. Beaches came out the week of my bat mitzvah, and I started. I started Blossom when I was 14, and Malloy was done right before Blossom was what's called a second position deal.
Did you identify with Blossom or so? Because it was a coming-of-age show.
Yeah, it was a coming-of-age show in a time when girls were not being prominently featured on television, which was really something really courageous. Don Rio created this show, and we kind of wanted to do, you know, Catcher in the Rye about a girl, a true coming-of-age story about a girl who was not a nerd and she wasn't a bimbo, which was kind of your two choices in the late 80s. We wanted to show a dynamic, interesting female, which I'd like to think all females are.
So we've come a long way since the 1990 mm-hmm. in that now you do play a nerd.
Now, right, I've come full circle, as it were, and then I get all pretty and dressed up for book tours and stuff.
You went to college after Blossom, mm-hmm. After that run ended. Did anyone recognize you?
Plenty of people. I walked off of your television into the quad at UCLA is kind of what it was like. I was shouted a lot for the good part of the first year.
And then people stopped thinking about it.
No, then they still shouted at me.
Did you think that you were going to go into neuroscience for a profession?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to be a research professor. My parents are both teachers, and I always loved teaching. But my husband and I, we met as undergrads. We had our first son in grad school and very quickly realized that we wanted me to parent a specific way at first and for us to have, honestly, a more flexible schedule. So I figured I'd audition here and there. I did not expect, you know, this blessing of getting on the Big Bang Theory. Who would imagine?
Well, you came onto a show that was already in progress. It was a hit. Mm-hmm. And everybody else kind of, I don't know whether the word is bonding, but they developed some acting rapport.
Mm-hmm.
Is it difficult to break into that kind of environment?
Yeah, I describe it like coming into, you know, high school 3 weeks into the first semester when everybody's picked out their lockers and who they want to sit with at lunch. I mean, in a way it's great because it's a well-oiled machine and they kind of know what they're doing. But socially it's hard. You know, people don't really think about a lot. They think about what they see and it's fun and we look pretty when we all stand in a row. But, you know, there's a huge social dynamic to any workplace and ours is no exception.
How familiar were you with the show and with Jim Parson before
I had never seen The Big Bang Theory, and I got the audition and was told, Big Bang Theory needs a female Jim Parsons, and I said, who's Jim Parsons and what's The Big Bang Theory? So I Googled him and watched about 10 seconds and did my best mimicry of him at the audition the next day.
Amy Farrah Fowler, your character, is a neurobiologist, not a neuroscientist.
That's
so you
right.
weren't typecast here.
Well, they actually added her profession once I was already cast. The first episode I appeared in, all we knew is that she was going on a date with Sheldon, but then they did make her a neurobiologist, which is a very, very ridiculous distinction that I won't even bore you with.
But often in the case of sitcoms, they start developing a character based on the person who's mm-hmm. playing that character. How much of you is in Amy?
There's a lot of me in Amy, but there's a lot of Jim Parsons in Amy. I like to say I have the easiest job because if I don't know how to say a line, I just wonder how Jim would say it.
Really?
But yeah, absolutely. But Bill Prady, you know, who created and is our executive producer with Chuck Lorre, you know, Bill said we might as well make her something Mayim can fix, you know, can fix script things about. So I guess that's why they did that. And I do.
and a lot of the humor comes actually from the way people react, their facial expressions, not just a lot of one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
So is that something the actors develop?
Yeah, I think it depends. I mean, I definitely think, you know, I'm a character actress. That's what we do. And I get a lot more reaction shots than I even realized. But, you know, it's part of having a flexible, fun face as a character actor.
So is that all worked out in rehearsals?
Yeah, and it's mainly guided by our actors. We've got a really interesting bunch of actors, so we do make all that stuff up as we go.
You have also a lot of ad-libbing during the rehearsals.
I don't know about ad-libbing, but a lot of the subtleties of characters, absolutely. I mean, to watch Jim Parsons, he's a master, you know, really creating a real personality around his character. So
master of the double take as well. You've said that you make a much better adult than you did a teenager or a child. Why is that?
I was an unusual kid. My parents are both very eccentric, and I guess I was an eccentric kid. But I'm one of those people who, as an adult, found things like embracing veganism or embracing observant Judaism, things that really resonate well with me as an adult, that as a kid I just kind of felt out of place and didn't know why I felt guilty when I was eating meat. And now I know, because I wanted to be a vegan.
Knowing what you know now, would you still take on a series as young as you did?
I mean, I say this in the kindest way. It kind of happened to me. I really feel like I was cast in Beaches. I didn't even really know what that meant, you know, that I would be in a movie. And it never occurred to me I'd be offered a TV show. And I really feel like I blinked. And I was 19 and I had 5 years of a primetime television show behind me. But, you know, life's really rich and big. And I had a lot of other stuff going on. I had all of my teenage years. And it's like having two lives, you know, is what it felt like.
On the show, you commissioned a painting of yourself and one of the other cast members. Do you get to bring that painting home?
No, that I would love to. Actually, I wanted to auction it for charity is what I thought we should do with it. It hangs proudly in our stage manager's office, looming over the entire set. Yeah, it is huge. It's 12 square feet.
Now that you're officially Sheldon's girlfriend, mm-hmm. although...
By the relationship agreement standards, yes.
Yes. Do you think that the relationship might move on to hand-holding or perhaps even kissing?
We've kissed once. There was an awkward cuddle, which was one of my favorite scenes. I think that people like seeing us hover where we are, and it seems to be working. You know, Chuck Lorre knows far better than I what works and what's funny, and I think we're sticking with this for now. But we keep dipping a toe in, and I think that's very sweet.
Well, when you did Blossoms, we didn't have all of these reality TV shows.
Sure.
It's really changed the whole nature of television. How has it changed in regard to working on a sitcom?
Gosh. Well, for me, because I was a teenager and now I'm an adult, that's one huge difference. The pressure on females outside of a set, I think, has gotten even more exaggerated with the internet, with the entire publicity machine that drives our industry, as it should at this point. But I think the social pressure, I think, has gotten much different. But for me, and I'm not trying to sound pretentious, the craft is still the craft, you know? I am paid to make you feel something. I am paid to bring a character to life from words on a piece of paper. I'm not paid to watch myself and examine, you know, how I look or if it's funny. Honestly, my job is over when we wrap on Tuesday night tapings and I go home to my kids.
Do you perform before an audience?
We perform before a live audience.
So you know if you've gotten your laugh.
We do, and if we don't, Chuck Lorre fixes it, and then we get the laugh and move on.
Mayim Bialik will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 6 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca. That's mm-hmm. on 97 Warren Street at Greenwich Street. And the book... This is a book that you obviously consulted with doctors like Dr. Jay Gordon on.
Dr. William and Martha Sears.
And the
Ricky
book
Lake.
Is called Beyond the Sling. If you've had a sling, you know what that's all about. A real-life guide to raising confident, loving children, the attachment parenting way. It is published by Touchstone. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today, and I'll see you on television.
Thank you.